Are you enjoying this so far? Good. Okay. All right. One thing I wanted to mention, well, I'm certainly enjoying this, and I'm really so happy that you're here and that you have the kind of questions that enrich what we're talking about, so don't hesitate to come up and ask a question if you have one. If you'd like to share this series of five talks with any friends or family members, we're fortunate to have Tom Heck, who is such an expert on all this, and he has set up these talks on the website. So it's wordinlife.us/calendar, and then when you get to this calendar, he looks for summer 2013, and there are the talks. So you can email the link to someone. Then I did give a one-day briefer version at Spirit Rock Retreat Center, more specifically on the part that we didn't talk about as much, which is love and relationships, both intimate and any kind of relationship. So if you're interested in this, it's a set of three CDs and it's on the back table. Yes. Okay, so let's remind ourselves of the special kind of love that we're shooting for here, which is a love that could be unconditional, which means we don't set conditions such as you're likable, you're appealing to me, this is going to be reciprocal, I like how you treat me, you're a family member, you're close. It's not conditions. It doesn't have conditions like that. Universal in its extent. So through our loving kindness practice, we're learning how to feel compassion for people far and wide. For instance, when we're watching the news, instead of just taking it as information, we're taking it as something to pray for, something to care about. Sorry for what's happening, and may things get better. And then finally, it's unflagging, which means we don't give up on all this. We keep trying. It's not as if we keep trying to get someone to love us. It's we're never giving up on the possibility that someone or others or people we care about will see the light and find the joy of these three kinds of loving in their own life. Make sense, everybody? And I know this seems impossible, and I'm remembering when I woke up this morning, I was thinking about Martin Luther King saying, I have a dream today, and I have a dream that black and white children will attend the same school, which seemed impossible at the time, but now it just happens automatically. The way it moved from dream to reality is that he believed it into existence. He kept believing it, and he kept doing all the things that could make it possible instead of impossible. And what are these things? So first you move the dream into a reality by having faith about it. And you do whatever it takes to show your love unconditionally, universally, and unflaggingly. And part of this would be putting your ego aside, which will be our topic today, so I'll go into that in detail. But there's more to it, because he didn't just believe it into reality. He didn't just put his ego and even his own life aside. He said, I believe it because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. So somehow you have to have the kind of spirituality that gives you a vision of a divine hand at work in all of what's going on in your own life and in history. Imagine having that kind of a belief. It's a spiritual conversion, and everyone has it by grace. It's a matter of opening to it. So I wanted to begin with that, and our topic today is this chapter 9, which is about the ego, but it's also about how this love that we're talking about can be directed toward God. I'll talk about that after the break. So for now, we'll go to our chapter that we've been discussing, or want to discuss. But anybody have questions on this part? So there is a love that's possible for us to show. It's different from the ordinary one that is ego-bound. Ego being the self-centered part of us that only wants to give if we're going to get in return. That's the opposite of unconditional. That only wants to love the tried and true, is selective, love family and friends, and not have a heart big enough to include everybody. That's the universal angle of it. And give up easily instead of keep at it. This would only be possible if we could let go of a central disability that began to be formed in childhood called the arrogant ego. Well, that's going to be part of our topic today. What's it a disability for? It's a disability to express love in these ways. I want to begin with a quick reminder of the three kinds of connections that are possible. And now I'm on page 133. This is a good summary of what we talked about so far and moves us into what we're on today. That you could say that there are three levels of connection. There's a simple positive connection, which is expressed toward everyone. It's shown in the form of being kind and courteous and respectful toward people that you meet. So that would be the first kind of loving. Second kind is the caring connection. So positive connection, now caring connection. Here we have a special love that involves closeness and intimacy, and it's reserved for people we know. So the first kind is for people we don't know but we meet. Second kind is for people we do know and are connected to. Third is for people we don't know and don't meet. These are people far and wide. And this would be our worldwide compassionate caring. That could take the form of praying for their well-being or contributing to programs that help them. Like people who are starving in other places. That would be an example. So it's positive connection, caring connection, and universal connection. And what gets in the way of all of this and what we've just been talking about takes us over to page 195. I have my little bulleted list. Just as we can't breathe in an atmosphere that doesn't have oxygen, so love can't breathe in an atmosphere where payback is demanded. I have to get back at you for what you did to me. As soon as that's in the air, including in an intimate relationship, then all bets are off for being able to love in this egoless way. Unremitting grudges. I'm still holding a grudge towards someone, and I no longer talk to someone, that kind of thing. It doesn't survive in that atmosphere. Third, on trying to be controlling. And controlling could even be, I need to fix you. I need to have you change so that this relationship can work better. That would be another form of controlling. A relationship in which there's one up and one down. Win or lose instead of cooperation. Only my way is the right way. Might makes right. People are for me to use or abuse. And being competitive. These would be characteristics of this arrogant ego, which I'm going to describe. So let's take a look at what we mean by the ego that can disable our chances for showing unconditional, universal, and you have to stand this up, and unflagging love. That would be the ego that is always trying to save face. If you've heard the expression, he's trying to save face. That would be he's trying to save this arrogant kind of ego. F-A-C-E is a good way to remember it. Four characteristics. One, it's afraid of true connection. And it's also afraid, this is the part of us that's afraid of true connection and afraid of not being liked. Afraid of being thought of as one down. Afraid of being thought of as not right every time. That inclination inside is a quality of this disabling, primitive inclination in us that gets in the way of our showing love unconditionally and so forth. Secondly, we're attached to being right. We're attached to our own point of view. Third, we have to be in control of people and events. So, needing to be in control is not just needing to be in control. It's a compulsion that supports this ego in us. This self-centeredness, ego is a Latin word for I, so it's I-centered instead of we-centered. In other words, it's not geared for the kind of world we live in. We live in a world in which the only way to survive is if we all care about each other. It's not geared that way, it's geared to me first. I'm up, pull up the ladder. That style. That's why it's a disability. And finally, it's entitled, this is the part of us that feels entitled to special treatment and to be honored, respected, and loved by everyone, no matter what. And I don't have to give it in return, and if you don't give it to me, I'll get you back. That teaching that went into our minds, starting in third grade, was disabling us from the ability to love later on or at any time. Everybody follow so far? And I use this as a little practice myself. I say to myself, when something bothers me, keeps bothering me especially, I say to myself, okay, David, what are you afraid of? What are you attached to? How are you trying to stay in control? And what do you think you're entitled to? And when I answer those questions honestly, silently, of course, I don't want anybody else to hear, I always get an answer. The answer is always the same. I'm caught in my ego. And it will feel like being caught. It'll feel like you're stuck in something. But for some people, this is all that we have to rely on. This is where we get our sense of safety and security, that I'm in control. When you're getting your sense of safety and security from I'm in control, you're getting it from a source that is not reliable. So the practice would be, we're not going to leave it right here because this wouldn't give us much hope. So wherever there is fear, how can I find a way to love? Where I'm attached, how can I find a way to let go and let the chips fall where they may and trust that I'll be able to pick them up and make the most of that? And if not, that I'll be able to grieve whatever I've lost and move on. Instead of being controlled, instead of trying to be in control, how can I allow people to be themselves? Instead of being entitled, how can I stand up for myself without having to retaliate if I don't get my way? How can I let it be okay that one of the givens of life is sometimes I won't get my way? If you were brought up in a household where you always got your way, this will be hard to do. When they were always giving you your way, they were disabling you. Disabling you from what? From being able to have healthy, effective relationships. So, in my own practice, then I ask myself the questions, David, what do you fear? And then I say, and how can you love instead? What are you attached to, and how can you let go? What are you in control of? How can you allow? What do you think you're entitled to? How can you stand up for your rights? But don't retaliate if you don't get them secure. Everybody follow? It's a really good practice, and I really recommend it. It's a way of finding the parts of yourself that get in the way of your true fulfillment. What is this true fulfillment? That you bring love into all your interactions. Questions about this? Jim, do you want to come up to the mic? Jim first, and then you.
Isn't a feeling an entitlement, a feeling that you have rights to someone? I mean, how do you separate those two to get a realistic picture of what your rights are? Because feeling entitled is thinking you have more rights than you have.
Yeah. Good. He's saying an entitlement. This is more of a sense that you walk around with. You have kind of a chip on your shoulder. And you're all supposed to acknowledge me because I'm so great. It's not really about your actual rights. The alternative would be to stand up for your actual rights without having to retaliate. For instance, one of our rights is not that everybody will love us and like us. I remember giving a class once in which I was on the topic of ego, and I was using as the example road rage, which is a great example of ego. Perfect example. Because if somebody cuts you off on the freeway, your actual first feeling is fear. It's scary. But of course, that big ego can't allow itself to feel fear, so it goes straight into how I'm entitled to be treated with respect on the freeway by all the other drivers. And so I will retaliate, I will beep the horn, I will flip them off, I will get really close to them, tailgate, whatever, all dangerous things. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to retaliate because he dared not to acknowledge my entitlement. But your actual entitlement is not to be treated with courtesy by all drivers. Your entitlement is to be able to use the freeway for which you have paid taxes. But you're not really entitled to be... It would be good if people showed courtesy, but it's not written anywhere as a right. Everybody follow? So that's the difference. And anyway, I was giving a class and I mentioned this, and I said, the bottom line is when that person cut you off, you're ultimately believing that he doesn't love me. Look what he did. He doesn't really care about me. So anyway, the week after, the guy raised his hand and he said, I was on the freeway this past week. Somebody cut me off. I rolled down my window and yelled out, you don't love me. Well, you got that right. Anyway, you see how it works.
People who have a sense of entitlement, are they aware that the entitlement is not really their right? I would think that somebody who's functioning under the idea that you're entitled to something, they wouldn't be able to analyze it.
Most likely not, since this is a blinding kind of thing. When you have this going on, which we all do, it operates automatically. It's a habit. It's unconscious.
Can that come out of early family?
Oh, yes. Very much so. Yeah. And a lot of this has to do with defensiveness. Talk into the microphone, it helps.
I'm going to revise that request because the microphone system isn't feeding into our recorder today. It's live and present here. So anybody that wants to talk from your seat, that's fine. Just speak loudly if you can. Okay, and I think
right.
We can take
good. Then let's go to Valerie. No, I have this. Yeah. Valerie?
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Rico.
Good morning. Okay, we have a question.
See, I'll tell you something. If you put this mic on, it's going to garble the sound a lot. Go ahead and try it.
It's not really a question. It's just something that occurred to me looking at the and it's all sort of covered by one basic commandment, and that is to love. And if fear is the opposite of love, which I believe it is, then they really can't exist in the same place, right? So all of this thing about, letting go, allowing me, and that shall not cover this sort of suffering in there, and all those things, that's sort of in the commandment. But that other thing that Jesus said, this above all, love one another, something to that effect, it just seems that you could just simplify it and just invoke love in whatever situation. And it's just very simple and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it.
Yes. Unfortunately, we have to train ourselves into that because our first and automatic reaction is often from the ego. Here would be a simple example. Let's say you're giving someone a ride. You're in the driver's seat, and the person gets into the passenger seat and slams the door very firmly. Like, kind of overdoes it, slamming it too hard. You say, with this car, you don't have to slam the door too hard. You can just close it in the regular way. Which is a very reasonable statement to make. And this is what you get in return. I had to slam it to be sure it would shut. See, that was an automatic, self-protective, defensive response because he can't be wrong. He's attached to being right. This is how that ego works. And that was not a loving response. That creates division. That could create an argument if the driver was foolish enough to pick up the gauntlet instead of just thinking, oh, I've got big ego sitting next to me here. Watch out. That would be another feature of letting go of your ego. You would no longer pick up the gauntlet when somebody else's ego is all aroused. In fact, you're going to try to be careful not to arouse that other ego, because it's very dangerous. Who was the Secretary of State under Nixon?
Kissinger?
Kissinger was being interviewed, and this topic was Vietnam. And, of course, he continued the war even into his second term. And Kissinger said, he told me that he didn't want to be remembered as a president who lost a war. So that's why he wanted to continue it until he could find a way to get out with honor. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, now how does that sound to a mother who has a son in Vietnam and hearing there's somebody in the White House and the way he makes his decisions, if he doesn't want to look bad, it's not about the lives. This is how big an ego can get.
It sounds like a malignant narcissist.
It takes over to such an extent that even life and limb no longer matter. Follow what I mean? Laura?
Let's see if I can say this. Hi. You brought back a lot of things about driving, and my father was a pilot, and he was an excellent driver. And I'm always slamming the doors in the Cadillac or whatever. But I just, it was not about... I just did it. It wasn't about anything else, but it was a habit. But that's besides the point. I think I agree about the fear and going to love. And I see when I drive, I can tell different things are going on. One is I can tell when I'm in my ego and really ticked off, And the other is what's wrong with wanting people to have good conduct so they don't kill other people? That's my thing about tailgating and things like that. It's not about I'm entitled. It's about behavior that's killing people on the freeway.
You're bringing up a good word, which is wanting. There's nothing wrong with wanting everybody to be courteous. It's just that we're not in control of what they actually did. Yes?
I'm curious about the driver who told the passenger, you don't have to slam the door.
Yeah.
How come, what was going on in him that he felt like it was necessary to tell the passenger that?
It could be just sharing information.
Yeah. He could just say it once and then go.
Yeah.
Or he could say nothing and just.
Or you could say nothing.
You
could say better not say anything.
If it happened repeatedly, then it would be something else.
Yeah. Good point. All right. So let's go on. Now we're over on 215. I want to take a look at this bulleted list because I think it helps. So once you. Have this ego at work, you would start to justify your right to get back at people. Because remember that the favorite sport of the ego is retaliation. Retribution. Get back at people. Don't let anybody get away with it. So everything in my relationship has to be reciprocal. When you have that going on, you want to let it go into a yield to a unilateral generosity. I'm just going to be as kindly as I can be, whether or not I get it in return. Imagine getting to this point. My justifiable outrage at losing face gives me permission to strike back. He has to pay for this insult. I have to get satisfaction. This is all the old challenge to a duel mentality. And the will to get even cancels the possibility of love. So the alternative is, I notice it, I say ouch, and I move on. Don't let people walk all over me. I do say ouch. I don't let it go on, but I go on without retaliating. I have to show I am justified in my behavior, and everyone has to acknowledge it. This is another feature of ego. Not only do I have to show that I'm right, but you have to acknowledge it. Everybody follow? Kind of like the difference between the Roman and the German style in the Inquisition. Medieval times. The Roman style is we torture you until you admit that you did it. Then we execute you. German style. We declare that you're guilty and then we torture you until you agree and then we execute you. Get the difference? And that second one is hard into the ego. Because you have to agree that we are right. And we do this in relationships. You have to agree that I'm right, or else I'm going to keep getting back at you. Next is a belief that there's a hell of eternal punishment or karma as a vindictive consequence to your behavior. As long as we're carrying around this belief that there's a hell of eternal torture, then that would justify us in hurting others. Because if God does it, why can't we do it? Everybody follow? In our tradition, in my childhood, all churches had a crucifix over the tabernacle, which was in the center of the altar. And it took me many years to understand something. The crucifix, which shows Christ dying on the cross, was meant to make the statement, He loved you so much that He died for you. He died for your sins. He loved you so much that He died for you. But as you look at it more carefully, if you were taught that God the Father demanded that He die for us to pay back the debt that we owed Him because of the sin of Adam and Eve, which is an old traditional view, no longer the one that we use now, if you believe that that's what's going on, then the crucifix says something else. It doesn't just say, this is how much He loved you, He, Christ, loved you. It says, this is what a father can do to you when he loves you. It's total male patriarchal control, even over your life. And that goes all the way back to ancient times when fathers did have control over the life and death of their children. So we want to look at that and ask ourselves, am I still carrying around the belief that there's a hell and people deserve it? Because nobody deserves endless torture, but everybody deserves the chance to change. The chance to make amends. The chance to be transformed. The ego doesn't want transformation. It wants retribution. Last year there was something on the news about, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a Oh, I remember. It was born-again Christians or some kind of fundamentalists, and they took to going to the funerals of servicemen who had died in Iraq or Afghanistan. And they were out there protesting and making fun of their sacrifice. You heard about this?
Mm-hmm.
Some of you have. Anyway, the interesting thing was I was listening to an interview. They were interviewing the leader of this group. And whatever state this was in declared it illegal from then on. But anyway, they were interviewing this guy, and this is what he said. Because the interviewer said, well, aren't you trying to, you know, help the people and see the light, you know, about war and all that? He said, no, we don't want repentance from people. We want punishment of them. And I thought, wow, that, where would you get that? We don't want repentance. We want punishment. That's straight from ego. But when you believe in hell, that's what you're actually saying. When you believe in purgatory, you're saying, even after death, people can still try to complete themselves, to work out the wrongs that they did in life. When you say there's a hell, you're saying, no, there's no chance for that. See the difference? Jin.
Going back to the cross.
Yeah.
What if Jesus wasn't showing we weren't supposed to get the message of how much he loved us and saved us? What if he was just showing that he recognized himself as a child of God and loved himself so much as that child in that relationship? He wouldn't betray himself and leading other people in that way instead of making them victims that he had to save by himself.
Yes. Yes. That's another really wonderful way to look at it. She's saying instead of Christ thinking of himself as a victim for others, he acted with integrity and accepted his own
Saying that we all are,
and this is where we're all
children of God.
Yeah, and we're all children of God. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Jenny.
Where does karma have business gate of consequence on ourselves behavior? I'm sure people could believe that, but you could also see karma as just being more or less an automatic response to the fact that.
Yes. Yeah, the healthy view of karma would be there are consequences to our behavior, but the ego version is you'll be punished for everything you've done. So instead of what goes around comes around, we would want to change that to may what goes around come around to help someone toward enlightenment. See how different that would be? Instead of, so you no longer say, what goes around comes around, because that's retaliation. You change that to, may what goes around come around to show him or her the light. See how that's a different way of being in the world? First version, what goes around comes around, is from this, from ego. The other version is from the heart inside of everyone that is capable of universal, unconditional, and unflagging love. And it's a whole different way of being in the world from this way of fear, attachment, control, and entitlement. And you can't just make it happen, you're kind of open to it. There is no microphone if you can talk from there. Yeah.
Stand up and speak.
It must have happened maybe 25 years ago or something. I was up in San Jose, and
we were going to have a family Thanksgiving dinner, and I had to go out and get some of the ingredients. And as I was on this road, it was two lane, or maybe four lane, there was a woman in her car that had stalled, and she had a lot of children in the car who were crying because they had to sit in the car so long. So very briefly, I hesitated on the road to lean over and ask her if I could help. Well, at that point, this car full of teenagers came by, and they whipped around me and gave me the finger. And I was so angry. I have never, ever in my life been so angry. And I was so angry, I was having a fantasy that I strangled those kids. And then I even got thinking about people who actually did it, who probably were in prison. It really gave me compassion for people who've been incarcerated for committing an act like that. So I went on and on, and I couldn't get rid of feelings. And I tried telling my relatives what had happened. When I came back to Santa Barbara, I told my friends what had happened, how unfair it was. But it didn't seem to help dissipate my feelings. So finally, I decided, and I was teaching at the time, and I thought, kids go through this all the time. They're out on the playground and maybe a bully hits them or something for no reason, or they have an unfair play on their, they're playing kickball or something, and they get struck out when they're not, when they didn't do anything wrong. And then we expect them to come back in the classroom and focus on their math lesson when they're feeling like that. So what I decided to do was to write a fable, because children especially, if they want to write a story about their incident, they don't necessarily want to use a parent's name or their teacher's name or principal's name, whoever it was that had committed this injustice. So I put it into the form of a fable, and the deer was me, and then the kids that were giving the finger whip were a rhinoceros, and so on. I went on like that, and made the illustrations and wrote the story. And as the ending part, and the moral of the story is, well, I was taking a script class at UCSB, and the whole class helped brainstorm for me what the moral was, and it was, no good deed ever goes unpunished. But I thought this would be a strategy for children, to write a fable about their injustice, and maybe adults as well. But I found out that by talking about it, it would not dissipate my anger. But what did dissipate it was go through this whole process of thinking of the idea of a fable and then giving it to other people, children, to write fables of their own and discuss it. And ironically, that helped me dissipate my own anger.
Well, thank you for telling us about that, because what you're saying is that there's a power in creativity that helps you let go. And what you were doing is you were letting go of the anger you were still holding because they contradicted your entitlement to be treated with respect. And by writing, you release that. So that was really good. Everybody see how that works?
Because creativity is unconditional.
Yeah, you can just do it any way you want. You don't have to follow certain rules. Like you can talk about rhinoceroses and deer or people. You can just feel free. This is the opposite of free, this being caught in ego. In fact, Joseph Campbell has a wonderful definition of hell. I just remembered. Hell is being caught in ego. That's hell on earth. When you're so caught in this, you just cannot let go. You cannot love, you cannot allow, and you cannot allow people to be who they are without retaliating if they disturb your peace of mind. That is the equivalent of being in hell. In Dostoevsky's definition, hell is the inability to love.
I wanted to make a response to that.
I went on a training one time. Do you all remember John Bradshaw?
Mm-hmm.
Those were the days. And he had a training where we talked about metaphors and doing our life story as a fairy tale or a metaphor. And it's really a great idea because it takes the edge off and it takes it out of you and puts it into another fable. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think fables and fairy tales are so good for kids. They mm-hmm. can see themselves in the dragon or whatever. So anyway, the other thing was using metaphors when we get angry or something. I'm trying to think of one. Somebody said something. She made me so angry. She was like a prickly pear. And there's something about a picture that takes away all the psych terms, too. You know,
mm-hmm.
Instead of using psych terms, make it a picture or use some other analogy.
Yeah. John?
I want to go back to what you're saying about Christ dying for our sins.
Yeah.
And how refreshing it is to be in a different kind of church than the Catholic Church, where we have the tabernacle with the fire for the cross over it.
Yes.
It's more open, less judgmental,
less
conditional. And I was wondering, you were saying that as growing up as children with these icons, I wonder if they're so far beyond us as children that we don't even register them, or if they really do have a profound effect on us. Because as a child, you would think, well, stealing that quarter from Becky's piggy bank, did that? Did you have to die for that? I mean, would that be so over the top that we wouldn't really even be affected by it? Or would it actually burden us in a way that would make it impossible to feel free?
Some people don't notice the images or even the teachings very carefully at all, and others take them very, very seriously. The more seriously you took it all in your childhood, the longer recovery period you will have to free yourself from all the parts of it that were based on ego rather than on real love. I went to a Catholic high school, and I remember once in the English class, the sister was putting this on the topic of, you better not apply to any non-Catholic colleges because you might lose your faith. And then she went into a long thing about, you know, how terrible that would be, and they make it seem as if other people's views are all equal instead of that there's one true view, which is our view. I'm sure some of you have heard something like that. Anyway, at the end of the class, I'll never forget this. And I was taking it all in. I was, oh, goodness, I better have to watch out. At the end of the class, the boy sitting next to me turned to me and said, David, what does it matter if we lose our faith? And I thought, oh, my God. Doesn't he get it? Well, that's the difference. I mean, for him, it was just going like water off a duck's back. And for me, it was going in. So it probably didn't take him as long to recover. All right, let's take a short break. 10 minutes.